Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Jody Peterman. We know that no one understands what you need better than you do. We take care to guide you through the legal process, ensuring that you're able to make the decisions that are best for you. If you have a personal injury, criminal, or family law issue, please take a look at our website to learn more about our practice. We offer a free initial consultation for personal injury cases. Give us a call at 229-375-5680. We have a reputation for being accessible and treating our clients well. We look forward to hearing from you.
Hello, I'm Guy Terry of Terry and Peterman. At Terry and Peterman, we are committed to representing the hardworking residents of South Georgia in personal injury, criminal, and family law matters. For years, we have worked with college students in this area to ensure legal issues do not disrupt their academic careers. We also represent military families struggling with divorce and family law issues. We rely upon over 30 years of combined experience to provide aggressive representation for our clients.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening, everybody. Hey, this is not bad. 2 weeks in a row, we're on the air with Peach State Pandemonium. This is Rich Tate. I'm joined so far by Jay West and Jerry Oates. Still waiting on Bobby Simmons to get on board with us here. Jay, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing okay. A little pollen season hitting here, but so my golden voice is not quite as golden as usual, but actually it's probably just an old voice, but we're trying. Actually, when I called in just a minute ago, it said there was no program scheduled, so maybe Bobby's trying to call in and he had a little problem too. I don't know.
Okay.
Then I said maybe somebody was not telling me something.
I kind of noticed you guys were sort of coming on late there. Jerry, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good tonight, guys. You doing all right, Rich?
I am doing well. Doing well. Practice tonight, luckily not a game. We still got two makeup games. That's why I was worried whether or not we were going to get on here tonight, but next week, I'm still not sure about, but I'm hoping so. Maybe we can get 3 weeks in a row.
Well, good. Speaking of which, you haven't really talked about how the team's doing. How's the team doing?
There's a reason for that. we're perfect five, if you want to call it losses. Yeah, we've put together five straight losses. You know, the sad thing about it is these kids are all great attitudes, good talent, but for some reason, I don't know, they always give up the big inning. They stay competitive right up until the last inning, and it's like you just lose them at that point, and we end up giving up too many runs to be able to make it back up.
How old are they?
We're coaching 13- and 14-year-olds.
Oh, okay, wow.
So, I mean, here's pretty good arms, pretty good gloves, pretty good bats, pretty good base running. We just can't piece it together.
Anybody suggesting a coaching change?
parents, yeah. so far, it's been fun. You know, it's my kids playing, so both of the other coaches' kids are playing. The head coach, his kid, he plays. So it's three parents and there's 10 of us, so, you know, it's kind of one of those deals where, hey, kids, don't go out and ride your bike too crazy and do too much. We need you for the game.
Well, it sounds like you're pretty safe under those circumstances. How much longer does the season go?
Through May, I want to say the 17th.
Okay.
Which is kind of good because the next Saturday my daughter graduates high school, and I don't think she'd appreciate me coaching that day.
No.
I'm sure that wouldn't go over real well.
Bet you never thought you'd have a daughter graduating high school. You know, it's time marches on, doesn't it?
Well, actually, this is the second one. My other one's a junior in college, so yeah, I'm going to have two kids in college at the same time. Hopefully, they can all get out before. Hopefully, they can all get out before my son does, before he gets in, because I don't think I can afford three of them at the same time. That's a bit much. All right, so we're talking tonight about the Hall of Fame, but I did want to get out real quick. I noticed today, and I'm sorry, I'm trying to text Bobby while I'm doing this. I noticed today that Mike Norris said that he was up to 150 feet today.
That's what
I saw.
Yeah, I saw that too, and it looks like every day is just a little bit more progress, and I think he's, you know, he feels pretty confident now, and things are on the up, and it really sounds great because, you know, that's what everybody was hoping for.
Yep. Sounds like he's making just, you know, really great progress. You know, it was scary there early on.
You're not kidding.
To see that he's where he is today, because if I remember Bobby right, the doctors didn't think he'd make it through that night. So that's pretty.
Yeah,
awesome.
It was a minute by minute situation, and it turned around, and you know, when it did, that progress started being made, but. I mean, it's just unbelievable to think how far the guys, you know, Mike has come. Just within the last three or four weeks, once he's got to the point that he was able to, you know, start taking steps, and that's really great.
Bobby has joined us. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. Sorry I'm running late tonight. Randy Corin, whom you guys all know, his wife suffered a stroke today.
Oh,
no.
And I went to the hospital, and it was a minor stroke. They got her to the hospital in time to give her some of the reverse medication to sort of take some of the effects away, but she's having some sort of seizure. They don't know what's causing that. They don't know if the seizure caused the stroke or the stroke caused the seizures, but she's in intensive care at Atlanta Medical Center, so kind of sent some good thoughts that way.
No kidding.
Yeah, let Randy know we're all in the corner there.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And one other thing I want to throw out, I got a phone call today from Bo James, and he asked me if I would mention this, I'm sorry I'm late. You guys may have already said something. last night on CNN, I don't know if anybody's seen it or not, but
I heard about it.
Nancy Grace read a list of names of wrestlers, and she, as we so often are, bunched together is just, oh, that bunch of wrestlers. It's not this guy or that guy. She read, I don't know how many names she read, but she said all of these guys died from drug overdose. There was probably five or six guys on that list that died in automobile accidents. There was at least one referee, a 165-pound referee, that died from cancer. So, you know, this lady just royally just butchered something without doing any research, and she's hurt untold families and untold people. And Bo said that anybody that's on Facebook, somebody on there, and he mentioned a name, and I'm sorry I forgot, but has got a petition that they're trying to get people to sign so they can forward it to CNN. This is just, I mean, this is insane.
This is the first time she's gone overboard and exaggerated on any issue. I mean, she's quite famous for convicting innocent people, and you know, I don't know. Nancy Disgrace is a good name for her.
Well, it's anyway. I just wanted to throw that out there if anybody might be listening. It's just,
well, you know, it's the with the Ultimate Warrior's death. This is a story. You know, the fact that you've got another. Professional wrestler that was well known in past just the wrestling magazines, and then he did have some media coverage in the past, and with him just leaving us, that left it open for somebody like this to take a stab, and probably had his death not occurred right now, she wouldn't have felt it was something that she would want to go after, but that's unfortunately just the way the business works.
Well, it called to mind today something that happened many years ago, and at the time I kind of looked, I kind of thought it funny or odd that it happened the way it did, but we were somewhere, and I don't even remember where we were, but the matches were being sponsored by the JCs or the or some civic group, and this guy knocked on the dressing room door, and I was dressing with the heels like I normally did, and this guy knocked on the door, and he came in, and he said, could I get a picture of the wrestlers here? We got a crippled kid or something. I mean, it was some catastrophe with a child, and said, could we get a group picture of you guys to give to this kid? And all the guys kind of got together except for Rock Hunter, and the guy looked at Rock and said, aren't you going to get in the picture for the kid? And Rock said, no. He said, if you want to take a picture of me by myself, I'll be glad to pose for you, but I'm not getting in a group picture. And when the guy took the picture of the rest of the guys and he left, Rock said, hey, guys, I know y'all think I'm probably a horse's fanny for not, you know. He said, it's not that. He said, when you take a group picture, he said, when the fans look at that picture, they're not going to say, oh, that's all the bad guys. They're going to say, there's a bunch of wrestlers in the dressing room cutting up and talking before their match. And he said, that's why I don't do that. And I understand his protecting the business, but that kind of came back to me today when I thought about this woman. You know, we went to such great lengths to protect our business, and here's this woman that just, with a simple few keystrokes on a computer, would have realized that her list was inaccurate, and you know, would have caused some harm to some families. But anyway, I'm sorry for being late again, but that was the reason.
I hadn't heard that story yet, about Nancy Grace, and I'm, you know, looking at what was going on today, and I hit the internet pretty good. But anyway, I appreciate you passing that along, Bobby.
Well, guys, y'all ready to get in it?
Oh, yeah.
We've been talking, obviously, a recurring series here about the Georgia Wrestling Hall of Fame. Tonight we're going to be discussing the class of 2009. This is going to be the after this, we're going to do three more shows. There's four more classes, but the last two are relatively small by comparison, so we're going to bunch those up final fourth show, and then we'll move on to some other themes. But for tonight, 2009, first name we're going to discuss, got to start here in the 60s, and well, we'll talk about Bobby Shane. Bobby, you want to lead off?
Never met him. We never crossed paths, which was odd. The last time he was here working was during the middle of the war, I guess they're calling it, in 73 and 74. We never crossed paths. We never met. I saw him work many times as a kid. I just got through reading Dean Silverstone's book and learned that Dean and Bobby were very, very close. When Bobby first started, he went out and he worked. He worked the Portland, not the Portland, but the Washington territory at the time before Dean had it. And Dean and him became very close, and Bobby helped him when he started his promotion sort of behind the scenes. But great mind for the business from everybody I've ever talked to. Had a great worked on top just about everywhere he was after his first few years. And I know he got a great push here when he was just a kid. And But I never met him. Is Jerry with us tonight?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. You can probably, I've heard you talk about working with him, so you can probably elaborate a little more than me.
Yeah, I wrestled Bobby quite a few times. He was, they had high hopes for Bobby. You know, Bobby was really older than everybody thought he was. He was here like the boy wonder, but he was, you know, they had him like at 18 or 19, but he was older than what he was, you know, what they were promoting. But Bobby had a, you know, he had some great runs. He had a, as Bobby said, he had a good mind for what we did, and he would have really done some great things. I think he'd have been a great booker, you know, if he'd ever got the chance to really be in control. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, his life was ended early, but he had his own style. If you never worked with him, you know, he was something else to work with. I know that. I know one night Bobo Brazil and I were tag partners in Atlanta, and I don't know who his partner was, but after the match was over, some guy come up and took a swing at Shane, and the cops grabbed the guy and had his arms behind him, and Shane nailed the guy right in the face. And I thought the cops were going to go berserk. It looked like they were holding the guy for Shane to hit him, but you know, back then nothing really happened out of it. But yeah, he was good for the business. He had his own style. He had his own way, and it's just unfortunate that he lost his life as young as he did, because I'm sure he'd have been a great booker for some territory.
Well, I've heard a lot of people talk about that. With working with him, would the word stiff come into play?
There was no doubt about that. I mean, I was shocked first time I ever wrestled him. I mean, he wasn't a polished worker, you know.
Yeah.
He had his own style, but evidently it got over.
Was he very good on the mic? I would imagine he probably was. He had that whole cocky thing going for him.
Yeah, he was pretty good. Yeah, he was pretty good. You know, he wasn't a very big man either.
Right.
Well, I remember him when when I got out of the Army in 69, and he had just come in as a young baby face, and he was wrestling under the mask, and he was teaming with Doug the Pro Gilbert, and he was a light heavyweight then. He was a small guy, as Jerry was saying, but he was very, very fast in the ring, and he worked here at that time as a baby face and did real well. He's one of the guys that's tied again to the Tampa Bay plane crash. He's been mentioned now, and I think he's probably about the last one that in that crash that we've talked about over the last few weeks. The story that I did for the Wrestling News discussed the fact that when he left here, you know, as a baby face, then he went over to Alabama into the Gulf Coast area and developed his new persona. And by the time he reached Florida, he had pretty well perfected it as the arrogant, sneering heel. And that's what he became, with the long shock, you know, blonde hair and the handlebar mustache and the valet you know, main evented down there. So I remember that right after the All-South Atlanta office split here, when he was brought back in, and I wasn't working at that point yet, but he was announced, and he came down from, you know, the backstage area, and Bobby Shane, and, you know, of course, all the ringsiders that didn't read the national publications were expecting this clean-cut guy to come out, and here was the king of wrestling, Bobby Shane, and he let the crowd know very quickly what his new persona was, and on that turn here in the area, he did very well, and he worked with everybody, and you know, he drew some money, and he was you know, quite a heel, both behind the mic, as you asked, with that persona that he had developed, and in the ring. So he was cut short. And I think there would have been an opportunity there, as Jerry mentioned, for him to go on into other things, because I think not only would he have been even a bigger successful guy in the ring, but working later on as a booker or whatnot, he was quite a talent.
And next up on the list in the class of 2009 is Elmo Chapel, went by E.L. Chapel. For the most part, in the public. The earliest he wrestled, or that I show him wrestling in Georgia, was 1933, but for the most part, he was known as a promoter for Marietta. The earliest I've got him there is 1951, working for the Atlanta office in Marietta at the Larry Bell Auditorium. And the last I show him promoting over there is 1966. He may have gone longer than that. I don't know. Maybe you guys can tell me about that. I'm not sure. You guys remember?
You got
that?
Me.
The only thing I remember about the Larry Bell Auditorium and the Saturday night shows that they would have there is that when they were doing Live Atlanta Wrestling on Saturday night, that they'd be doing the interviews live, and the guys would have to leave directly from the TV show to go to Marietta. Fortunately, it was a short stop, but still it was hectic, as I understand it, for them to go from the Atlanta TV to Marietta to work on Saturday nights.
Maybe sometime in the future we can get Charlie Smith when we're not strapped for time in the series we're running. I'd like to get Charlie in on this because I don't know, Bobby, if you'll remember, we were doing back when we really first started doing those get-togethers over at your former church. I invited and brought over, I want to say it was his sons. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I remember. I remember somebody Charlie. Coming, yeah.
Yeah, and they talked about the Larry Bell Auditorium, and and them going there. Yeah, it was that was interesting. I do remember that.
Charlie has told me. Jerry, did you ever work Larry Bell?
No.
Charlie told me that was the most dangerous place in this territory at the time it was running. He
and
said they had
that?
A riot there one night, and Buddy Fuller, who was the biggest baby face in the territory, ran down there to help somebody, and they said Charlie said they cut him from elbow to elbow. So he said it was a pretty bad place.
Wow. I know when that building burned down, they ended up at the Larry Bell Ballpark running shows. So I don't know. I don't know where that would have been in Marietta. Anybody know?
I have no idea.
No.
But anyway, at any rate, I do remember bringing those guys over, and I lost touch with them. And I'd love it. I don't know if you're listening or keeping up with us anymore, but they had actually tracked me down through GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, and that's how we met, and just kind of lost touch with them over the years, and I'd love to fish their brains for a little bit more info on them, but I know Charlie kind of had a long discussion with him because I know he remembered them, or he remembered Mr. Chappell, so maybe we can get him on here sometime and talk a little bit more about him and find out a little bit more. Next up on the list, I'm sure everybody's got some stories here. The late, great Freddie Miller. Jay, I'll let you start with that.
Well, you know, I knew of Freddie a long, long time before his involvement in professional wrestling. He was one of the guys that in the 50s and the 60s that, you know, I looked up to as a professional broadcaster. And he was around in the days that everything was done live. In doing research on Freddie, he was 18 years older than me, so he was well established by the time I was trying to get my feet wet into broadcasting. But, you know, he started out, I'm sure Bobby can elaborate on a lot of this, he worked very closely with Freddie, but he started out in radio. He was a radio DJ, and he did sports. He loved sports. He wasn't a big wrestling fan. It was a job to him, and I think Freddie did a lot better job than a lot of people gave him credit for. But, you know, as I've mentioned before, he was known for two iconic television shows in the Metro Atlanta area, Stars of Tomorrow in the 60s, which was a local talent show, and their gimmick was that, you know, one talent from that show each year would go to New York for the Ted Mack Amateur Hour, and you know, when that show went off, it kind of killed Stars of Tomorrow, but there was a lot of talent that went through that program that Freddie helped. And then his second show later on in the 70s was Dialing for Dollars, which was an afternoon movie show. And that thing was so popular on Channel 11, which was the ABC affiliate at that time, that Dark Shadows, which was on the network, which was on the same time that they were doing the Dialing for Dollars show, actually was preempted and tape delayed and showed later on. But Freddie had two very big TV shows. A lot of people, you know, liked Freddie. A lot of people didn't like Freddie. He just had that kind of personality that either you clicked with him or not. But when I actually met him after the All-South split with the Atlanta office, Jim Bell, I knew him from Griffin Radio, and Jim was working, you know, in Griffin as the announcer there, and he wanted to get it to become a referee. Anyway, he talked to Freddie, and Freddie called me, and I started doing the Saturday TV show when it was an hour, and Freddie was very nice to me, and we stayed in touch over the years. He was very hyper, and you know, very, very hyper guy, and sometimes you just didn't know how he was going to react to certain things. But at any rate, I got along with him very well. And when I left the TV show, I was still doing Griffin, and he called me later on and wanted me to work Friday nights so he could do some shows on the road. And so, you know, I started doing the Atlanta show on Friday nights at the City Auditorium. And he, Freddie was, you know, he would tell me what he could. And actually, in the early days, he asked me a lot of stuff about wrestling, because if it wasn't happening there, then he, you know, he wasn't really that knowledgeable. As time went on, he became very, very knowledgeable because he saw tapes from everywhere. But we got along real good. And even after after I left, was let go in 81, Freddie had his advertising agency, and he put spots for the wrestling cards at the Omni on my show on Saturday nights and Sunday afternoons, because you know, he thought it was worth it to do that, and I appreciated it. But we weren't real good together. After I quit doing music on Friday nights in order to accommodate Freddie, he paid me a little extra money out of his own account, you know, to help me make up the difference. So we got along good, and I respected the man for what he did. And, you know, I'm sorry that I lost contact with him when I did, but he was an icon in Atlanta television.
Bobby?
I giggled when he said hyper. That you look up hyper in the dictionary, and Freddie's picture's there. Freddie was, Jay summed it up when he said it was a job to Freddie. Freddie was not a wrestling fan. He was a broadcaster.
Yep.
That was his deal. He that's what he wanted to be. And actually, I honestly think Freddie thought wrestling was beneath him as far as his stature in the broadcasting industry. But Freddie was so hyper, and he was very outspoken, and Freddie had burned a lot of bridges over the course of his career. But, yeah, Freddie, at one time, Freddie was the play-by-play guy for Georgia Tech football before Al Ciraldo. Stars of Tomorrow that he mentioned, there was a young man named Joe James tap danced on that show when he was just a young teenager. Guy actually became a fireman and later got a break and became Bob Armstrong and started wrestling. Brenda Lee.
Yes.
Great country performer. That was Freddie. That was one of Freddie. All you had to do was mention her name and you'd get Freddie in that hyper mode, because he discovered her. She was a local product in Atlanta and had a voice just unreal. Her biggest hit, it's gone away from me now. She recorded it when she was 15, and they were afraid to release it in Nashville because they thought she was too young to be singing that kind of song.
I'm sorry.
But that's it. That's exactly it.
I played
it
many times.
He got hot about it because he would do spot shows with Stars of Tomorrow at high school gymnasiums and would draw pretty darn good. And he'd take this local talent and he'd pay them, you know, a little bit to go perform. But he was drawing good houses with that. Well, Brenda Lee was kind of his star, and I'm not sure how, but some way she got hooked up with an agent or something, snatched her out of Freddie's arms and took her to Nashville and made a bunch of money, and Freddie got nothing. But that was a big thing with Freddie. Freddie was good at what he did. He could communicate with people well, and Jay hit it right on the head. You either clicked with him or you didn't. You either liked him or you couldn't stand him. The guys loved to rib him because Freddie was such an easy target, and he would go crazy, and he did a good job though. Out of all he did, mentioning the TV shows and the radios and the things he did, the one major regret that I have for Freddie in the time that I've known him, I wish he had copyrighted the phrase.
Oh yeah,
be there. Because one of the networks picked it up and it became their catchphrase for two or three seasons. And that was a Freddie Miller invention. And whatever I learned from doing interviews and cutting radio spots and doing those things, I learned from Freddie Miller. And Freddie did a good job at what he did. And Freddie worked for Ann a few times in 1985 when I was helping her do some TVs. I recommended him to her, and he came on board and did a few shows for her. And I had a chance to work with Freddie a little more during that time, and glad I did. And
the show he did on Sunday night, the Best Of show, was very high rated. You know,
yeah.
I will say that I do remember seeing Freddie look like he was, you know, sweating bullets in his tuxedo when he introduced that first show when Vince McMahon took over.
Oh.
And, I mean, he was white as a sheet. And, you know, it's he really looked scared to death.
Jerry, what have you got to add about Freddie?
They pretty much summed it up. He was as entertaining behind the camera as he was in front of it.
Isn't that the truth?
I like Freddie. I always got along with him well.
You know, Bobby, you did say something about him kind of just sort of, I guess, being embarrassed or thinking, I guess, wrestling was beneath him or whatever. I always heard, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I always heard that he once did an interview, I guess, in the late 80s or something. I'm guessing it was the Atlanta paper, but he was apparently asked about that, and he basically said it was the worst thing that ever happened to his career.
Well, once he started with wrestling, and once he got that superstation and the TV and the things hit, he became synonymous with wrestling. People like Jay and myself that have lived in Atlanta a long time, we remember Stars of Tomorrow. We remember Dialing for Dollars. We remember those things. But to the wrestling fans that came along, the only thing they knew Freddie was for wrestling. And I'm sure when he would go to try to get announcing jobs or get hooked up with a TV station to do voiceovers or whatever, I'm sure that came into play possibly they said, hey, we can't use you because, you know, your voice is wrestling, and then that's not what we're looking for to sell our product. And
right.
I don't know that happened, but I can see where it would have happened. And,
sure.
You know, that's kind of – I can see where it would be a curse.
It was. For announcers, you know, there were a few exceptions to that in, you know, Memphis, the guy there. But once they were tied to professional wrestling, which was considered entertainment and really bizarre by some standards in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, it was the kiss of death for doing any other type of work.
All right, guys, next up on the list, I'm going to get Jerry on this one first. Dandy Jack Crawford.
Dandy Jack. He was one of a kind. He did his job well. He did it well. I guess he had as much heat as any manager ever had around here. And he did it right. You know, he was El Mongo's manager and did all the talking for El Mongo. And I don't know what to say about Dandy Jack, but he was here a long time. I know that. And you know, as far as I know, he got along with everybody.
For anybody that was maybe too young to miss out on him and they've only really read about him, kind of like myself, who maybe from the 70s, 80s, 90s would you say was maybe most like his style of being a manager?
Hell, there was nobody.
No.
He was... I'm not trying to be funny here, and I'll tell you how I was with the guy. But he was snaggle-toothed. He had teeth missing. He wore a Bo Brummel type hat. He did not have a lot of hair. I'm not exactly, Jerry, would you agree? He wasn't a good-looking guy.
He wasn't a pretty fella, no.
No. And he wasn't the most eloquent speaker in the world. He was very plain-spoken. I mean, his voice was not, he did not have those mellow tones.
Talk with that twisted mouth.
Yeah, and he toted a cane, and he wore a tuxedo.
Yeah,
you know, not the tails, but he wore, you know, like a dinner jacket, a black dinner jacket, and the black pants with a little satin stripe down the leg, and the polished shoes, and he he come across like a used car salesman,
yeah.
I guess is the best way I could describe it.
A huckster or a carny type guy.
There you go.
And you know, he was one of the first managers I ever remember seeing on television once I was old enough to know that I liked professional wrestling. And, you know, he'd come out there, like you said, and the outfit that he wore just, you know, it was 180 degrees from what his personality was. So he was trying to present himself as something that he wasn't, but that was just part of the, you know, that was part of the act. But he came on like he was a barker on the sideshow at the Carney. And he was very, very good at what he did, and people hated him. But the idea was he didn't understand that. You know, he thought that he was, you know, really, really personification of a cool guy, and he couldn't understand why the audience didn't like him, which was, once again, the gimmick. He when I think back, if you say who was one of the earliest managers on Live Atlanta Wrestling, it would be Dandy Jack, and he managed a lot of different guys. And then he was one of the ones that was brought back very early, once again, after the All-South split. And Jim Bell, who was there at the office, got the booking office there to run some spots on WSSA, which is where I was working in Morrow at the time in 72 after the split. And in exchange for that, I did some interviews with a couple of the guys, and one of them was Dandy Jack. And we talked a few minutes about what we were going to do and went through it. And then he said, of course, now when I end it, I'm going to end it with "the pleasure was all yours." And that was kind of his catch line when he would
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Yours.
Yeah, well, when we went in, but I considered that a little bonus for me to be able to, before I actually had anything to do with wrestling, to be able to talk to him offline and get him to talk about how he was going to do his interview.
When I was a kid, of course, I was just going to the matches as a kid when El Mongo, you know, came. And, of course, as Jay said, everybody hated Dandy Jack. El Mongo was a... And El Mongo was pretty much a wrestling heel. He didn't do a lot. I mean, he used the karate and the, you know, but he was a good wrestling heel. And, of course, when I finally got into the business, Jack Crawford was out of the picture. He worked a few shots for the Atlanta office while I was at Gunkel. But in 85, when we were working for Ann there for those few shots, we filmed some TVs in Macon at a cable station there on a Saturday morning, and they brought Jack Crawford in, and they were going to do some, I don't think we used him at all in house shows, but they brought him in, and the premise was we showed him standing behind the cameras. We just kind of caught a glimpse of him, and I had the announcer say, "Hey, that's Dandy Jack Crawford, one of the most famous managers, blah, blah, blah." But I got to do an interview with him on camera, and Jay, you're talking about that line. I remembered that from a kid. And I had chills run up and down my back. And
oh, yeah.
I am in the business. I've been in it for a long time at that point. And this guy does this interview, and I almost blew the interview when he said it.
Yep.
And when they finally cut the camera off, I asked him, I said, "Can I hug your neck?" And he went, "Yeah." And I hugged his neck. And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Man," I said, "as a kid, you don't know how many times I hated you for saying it." And I said, "What a pleasure it is.
Yep.
To stand here and get to do this with you."
I agree.
He was just a nice guy.
Yeah, I felt the same way when I did the early interview with him in the in 72 at the end there.
Yeah. When he left the business there shortly after that, Jay, he went to work for a construction company. He was in Snellville for years working for a construction company. That's
Wow.
where he was working when we did the thing in 85 with Ann.
That's unbelievable.
But I heard somebody told me that he had passed away down in Florida a few years ago, but I hate there's not any tape or anything out there on him, because maybe somebody on a Super 8 or something's got it hidden in their attic and it'll show up someday. But yeah, he was a heat magnet, man. Just and he didn't have to try hard.
And Rich, once again, to say who you could compare him to, I couldn't think of anybody.
Okay. Well, speaking of heat magnets, next up on the list is Jerry Graham. Jerry, did you ever get to work with him?
Never did, Rich. I only met him one time. I was really never around him.
Okay.
That's a blessing, my boy.
That's my
I'm sure Bobby can, since he spent his last era there working for All South. I'm sure Bobby can give us all the gory details.
He was, you know, some guys have it and some guys don't. And I'm not sure what it is that you're describing, but he had it. He could walk into a building and generate heat and never open his mouth, not only with the fans, but with the boys. He had a vast knowledge of the wrestling business. He was very smart about the wrestling business, but he was in his own world. To get the full impact of Jerry Graham, you need Joe Turner on the show to tell you about the time that him and Bill Bowman, working as the interns, had him as their manager. I mean, it's just he come in here and he would if he rode in your car with you, he was prone to just pee all over your front seat because he would get so drunk he would pass out. He would he was obnoxious. He was loud. The only time he ever rode with me, I went from Columbus to Athens on a Thursday, and I had the shorter of the Oates boys with me. And we were in my car, and we get to Athens, and we're getting ready to leave, and Charlie Smith had took him to Athens, and there had been a little mishap in Charlie's car, and Charlie refused to bring him back. And Renesto gets me off to the side and goes, "You got to take him back to Atlanta." And I said, "Tom, I'm not going to Atlanta. I'm going to Columbus." He said, "Oh, you're going to Atlanta first." So Ted's in the back seat. I'm in the front seat, and he's over by the window. You know, of course, I'm driving. He was staying at the Domino Lounge, or at the Imperial Hotel, which was over the top of the Domino Lounge. Which
oh,
was
I remember that place.
Very seedy, divey place in downtown Atlanta. We pull into the parking lot, and he gets out of the car, and he hollers, "Hey, you SOB." And this guy came out of the parking attendant's shack with a gun in each hand. And me and Ted had a double knockout going for the flowboard. And the guy goes, "Oh, it's just you." And the guy, he said, "Bring me some change." And the guy came, I don't know what it was all. Anyway, he winds up throwing 20 bucks in the car, and I said, "Well, you don't owe me that much money." And he goes, "Yeah, dude, you keep it." And that's just the way he was.
Well, folks that only knew him from the very end of his career, you know, if you Google and you look at him, he was a very, very big star in New York in the late 50s, early 60s. And I remember when he first came here in the 60s with, you know, as the Graham Brothers. And, you know, he did very well. He was a major attraction.
In New York, he lit cigars with $100 bills.
Yeah, he was in, rolling in it. You know, he was just another one of those guys that were their own worst enemy. And Charlie Smith just told me some stories about you know, the All South days there and some of the problems he caused. But I saw him on, you know, where the little ticket office was for All South downtown.
Yeah.
I saw him down at the corner one day. I mean, he looked like he was, you know, I guess he'd been by the office there, but it looked like he was, I don't know who he was waiting on, but you know, he was yelling out at the people driving by. So, you know,
one more Jerry Graham story just to top this off, to tell you how he was near the end of his career and his life, actually. But Bill Bowman was, they were, at the time we were working for Ann, we were doing a joint promotion with Carlos Colon in Puerto Rico. And they would send guys over there to, you know, work for a week or 10 days or whatever, and then they would come back. And, Bill Bowman was staying at a hotel across the street from the hotel where Jerry was staying. Jerry was staying at the El San Juan, and there was a swimming pool in the lobby of the El San Juan Hotel. He comes in one night after the town, and he dove in the swimming pool, clothes and all, and he begins to strip. Now, the thing about Jerry Graham was, even though as big as he was, he could swim like a fish and could float like a rubber raft. He wound up on his back, butt naked, floating around the pool, the swimming pool, in the lobby of the El San Juan Hotel, and they couldn't get him out. So they went across the street and got Bill Bowman because Bill, you know, had been, Jerry had been his manager for quite some time. Bill came over there and talked Jerry out of the pool, and they said he got out of the pool, he picked his suitcase up. Now, there's clothes floating all in the pool, and he walks naked up the steps right out of the grand staircase there, right out of the El San Juan going up toward the second floor to where his room was. So that was kind of how Jerry Graham was.
Well, if you'd have had the internet back in those days and YouTube and all that stuff, we could, you know, I guarantee you'd be there.
Not too far from the tree. Next up is Luke Graham.
Luke was a nice guy. I just hated that he liked to turn the bottle up a little too much, but he'd always go out there and work hard. I was in Louisiana with him. I was in where else was I with Luke? Kansas City. He was out there around here in Georgia with him. Luke was a good guy. I just you know, he had some good runs up north, but I think that bottle got the best of him.
Luke was one
of the, quite a bit.
Yeah, Luke was one of the guys that I always wanted him to have at least one in his system before he went to the ring because it calmed him down. If he didn't have any in his system, he was a little jittery. Yeah, Luke was from Georgia. He was from around somewhere right outside of Macon. Grayson, Georgia, I think is where he was from. Not Grayson, but Gray, Georgia. And but Luke, right place, right time, became a Graham brother in New York, made a lot of money. One of the easiest guys to be in the ring with of anybody I was ever around. And Jerry was right, he worked hard. He went out and he didn't have to back up to the pay window. He worked hard. And
he did do that.
Yeah, just a fun guy. Great guy to be around.
Yeah, if you only knew him from here, actually, as has been mentioned, he had a big career in all around the country. You know, he settled here at the end, but he wrestled in a lot of major booking offices and did real well. I introduced him a couple of times on TV and also at the Omni, and I remember one match at the Omni. He worked with Lou Fez in what was at that time one of Lou's going out of business matches that he did all over the country, and Luke broke character and shook Lou's hand at the end, and he also had that phrase, you know, which was, don't call me crazy, and that's what you would do. You'd introduce him as Crazy Luke Graham, and then he would come running over to the announcer and say, don't call me crazy, and do his bit with the audience. And that was kind of the little routine that we would do when I'd introduce him, which, as he did with everybody. But then the crowd would start going, Crazy Luke, and he'd put his hands over his ears and, you know, stomp around in the ring before the match started.
All right, next up on the list, the great late and great Mae Young. Bobby?
Well, I got to know Mae through the reunions. Never had the privilege to be in the ring with her. I heard a lot of stories, a lot of wild tales that I'm assuming are all true. I'll just relate a couple of them to tell you how she was. Bob Kelly said when he went to Florida, one of the first days he was there, they told him that Mae Young would be about to pick him up. He was riding with her. And when Mae stopped to pick him up, she had a convertible. And Bob said he went out and got in the car and said she was smoking a cigar. And he said, to quote Bob Kelly, he said, I was afraid of her. So that was his baptism of fire with Mae. But I guess just to tell you how she was, Sputnik Monroe told me the story that he was in Memphis and he said he had bought a new pair of cowboy boots. And he was standing in the dressing room. He said he was the first one in the building. He said he got to the dressing room and he said he didn't have anything on but that pair of boots. And he said he was completely naked except for the boots, and he was standing in front of the mirror looking at his boots. And Mae walked in the dressing room. And he said he grabbed a towel and wrapped it around him. And he said she walked by, grabbed the towel, snatched it off of him, threw it down, and said, "Hey, I'm just one of the boys." So that's kind of how she was about the business. But what a sweetheart of a lady she was. And fortunate I got to be with her last year at the reunion. She got to make the reunion and got to spend a little time with her. So she's going to be missed by our industry and by everybody that she came in contact with.
Jerry, were you ever around me?
I only met her at the reunion in Mobile. That's the only time I ever met her. And I asked her then, I said, "May, how long have you been in the business?" She said, 60 years. And so Ole and I were sitting together. I said, "Ole, did you ever cross paths with her out there anywhere on the road?" He said, "I never saw her anywhere." And I didn't either. Never saw her. I don't know where else she worked, but I never saw her. But she was a nice lady. I enjoyed talking to her. But I never saw her out there anywhere.
Yeah, I got to meet her out there. She was very, very sweet. Yeah, she wrestled in Georgia from 1943 to 1962. So I don't have anything on her after that here. Jay?
Well, you know, if she worked on the DuMont show, which I vaguely remember as a young child, you know, I didn't place her from that, but she probably did. But I never saw her work during what would have been, I guess, her late prime, which would have been the 60s or, you know, late 50s, early 60s. Honestly, what I know about her, I know through Dave Meltzer's Wrestling News and the articles that he would write about her in her very late career when she was doing various things for WWE with the Moolah. And she obviously right up to her death got a great deal of publicity from that. I don't know personally how she felt about being paraded around like that, but I'm sure it made some money for her and got her some notoriety that she probably didn't get even in her early day. But what I've read about her said that she was, during her prime, she was quite a performer.
All right.
Yeah, she went through a table up there at 80 years old.
Yep. Yeah.
Next up on the list, a guy none of you guys are really going to know. None of you will ever work with him. Tom Mahoney, he actually began wrestling in Georgia in 1932. He had a big run for the Atlanta office in the 1940s. As a matter of fact, he began promoting Augusta in 1949 and did that through 1956 when it went over to Bibber McCoy. I can't remember right off the top of my head here who he replaced in Augusta as the promoter, because he had resumed business there. Abe Simon, who I believe we've discussed here on and off before, had promoted in Atlanta prior to Paul Jones. He had run Atlanta and Augusta at the same time before Paul came in and eventually helped expand to the territory that we all knew later. But Mahoney ended up promoting Augusta to help Paul build up that area, because when he replaced whoever it was, after Abe had left, nobody was working with the Atlanta office out of Augusta. It was run independently. Mahoney brought that back. And that's the two biggest cities in Georgia, always has been. And so that kind of, I guess, gave him sort of a, at least the beginning of the circuit that we came to know. Mahoney did win the first Southern Heavyweight Championship, which, of course, ran into, I want to say, the late 60s, even after the Georgia title. I know it was still defended by Buddy Fuller in probably 67. But he was the winner of what they claimed was an ongoing tournament for several months in 1949, dating back to the spring, even though none of the results that we found have actually indicated what matches those were. Pretty sure that was just a, phantom title change kind of deal where they just sort of claimed they had a tournament. But at any rate, he won it. And his family, as of about, I want to say, 3 years ago, maybe about four, his family still had that original Southern Heavyweight title belt.
Wow. There's been several guys that you've talked about from that era that, you know, I actually knew nothing about. So this has been very educational for me, is to just hear about some of these guys from the 30s and the 40s that you've brought some information out on. It's, you know, and it's been very interesting.
Well, thank you. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of footage on a lot of those guys, but, you know, it's when you get a chance, you know, if you get a chance to see any of those guys, it's great. But, you know, for the most part, it's all pieced together based on, you know, historians doing research and us assembling cards and just taking a look at them and seeing, you know, where they fell on the card and what they did over time. But he was definitely through in the 40s, had a nice run in working for the Atlanta office. Closing out the class of 2009, I'm sure you all got stories on these guys, the Vachons. That being Mad Dog, Butcher, and Stan.
The only one I was ever really around was Butcher. I remember seeing Stan and Butcher, you know, wrestling in Columbus when I was younger, before I started wrestling,
right.
But Butcher was the only guy I was ever around, really. Not a lot in Atlanta early on, but other than that, I was never really around. I was never around Mad Dog. I'm kind of glad, but I was never around. There's some stories on him.
Yeah, they had a great run with the Torres brothers there, 66, 67 era, 68.
Yep.
Oh, gosh, they sure did. They really did. Yeah, those four drew some money.
If I'm not mistaken, wasn't that Leo Garibaldi that was booking at that time, and those guys that all ended up in under masks over that period of time? I know Butcher at some point was Okiyama. Seems like one of the Torres brothers ended up under a mask at one point.
That Leo was doing the booking then.
Yeah. Bobby, I'm sure you got a lot of memories of that as a fan.
Well, I'm like Jerry. I was just going to the matches when they had that run with the Torres brothers back then. I never had the privilege of being in a ring with any of them. But I did get to meet Butcher and Mad Dog in Las Vegas at the Cauliflower Alley Club. And I talked with them a little bit, but I've talked with Butcher more than of course, Mad Dog's gone now, but I talked with Butcher more than any of them. He told about, we've talked about the run he had here, and, you know, he remembers, you know, the thing, you know, the work in the program with the Torres brothers. And he also had a program with Mario Galento where they did Hangman Ho versus Hangman Ho.
Right.
He did a loser leave town thing, left, you know, had to leave, came back under the hood. Dandy Jack managed him, if I remember correctly. You know, something I learned about Mad Dog, I did not know this. I learned out in Vegas and talking with different people. But Mad Dog actually wrestled on the 36th Canadian Olympic team.
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah, he was a, you know, he wasn't first or second chair, but he was on the team. And Butcher was like the national Canadian amateur champion or something. I mean, these guys could wrestle. And you know Butcher was as a kid, I remember him being such a huge guy, and now that I get around him, he's got a few years on him now, and he's stooped over a little bit, but I just can remember as a kid, and of course, I guess as a kid, everything's magnified to you, but I remember him being just a monster, just a big guy. But, they were drew a lot of money here.
If I remember correctly, Paul Butcher Vachon also had a operatic voice that he would let go of sometime in the dressing room. I don't remember much about him. Stan, who is not really a brother, of course, I saw information on him in the various after mags is Stan Pulaski, and then he would work here, and I can remember introducing him in Griffin as Stan Vachon. But Mad Dog, who of course was the biggest draw, Canadian they were, and as Bobby said, he was on the Olympics, but he was AWA champion 5 times, and you know, he had a major career, and he did come in here one time during the early days when I was working one of my stints as ring announcer on TV, and I remember him doing interviews and introducing him a couple of times, but you know, I don't. By the time I was doing that, he wasn't working here regularly, and I don't remember a lot about their teaming with or going against you know, guys in the 60s, primarily the Torres, but great stories about the run that they had against those guys. And you know, I was glad to have the opportunity at least to say that I had introduced Butcher one time or a couple of times in Atlanta.
Well, guys, that wraps it up for the 2009 class. And the clock on the wall at Bobby's house says it's 9 o'clock.
Sure it is. when Debbie was with me, she wanted the clock set 6 minutes ahead, so that she had 6 minutes to get to her next TV show, whatever that might be. When, but since Debbie's not with me now, I've actually set it on the right time, so it should be 9 o'clock.
So does it do that every hour?
Does it every hour, and I don't even hear it. I mean, it was a wedding gift to me and Debbie 27 years ago, and it's been on our mantle ever since, and I don't even hear it anymore. I guess it's like living next to the train track, and you'll ask them, what about the train? What train? You know.
Right.
Well, guys, you got anything else before we wrap it up for the evening?
I'm good.
I enjoyed our conversation tonight. I'm glad we were able to get together, and hopefully we'll get a win on that team, you know, shortly.
Well, hopefully. Yeah. I don't know. We're perfect so far. Might as well keep it going. Right?
Yeah. Did you get the Rich? Did you get the envelope I sent you?
I did. No,
okay, good
deal.
Yeah, I sent you an envelope. I sent you an envelope too. We're being clandestine here.
Yeah.
That was awesome and great help. All right,
okay.
Guys. That's going to do it for us this week. Then I'm hoping for next week. Still not sure though, but we'll see.
Okay.
Okay, guys.
All right, guys. Enjoyed it. Have a great week.
Good night.
Good night, guys.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.